Welcome to Masters of the Stage. This SDC Foundation program illuminates the creative processes and personal and professional experiences that guide today's luminary directors and choreographers as they forge artistic careers in a profession that has no handbook. These dynamic conversations with today's most successful artists offer rare insights into the challenging and ever-changing world of theater making. This episode was recorded at a live event sponsored by Stage Director and Choreographer Society and Stage Directors UK on February 24, 2019 in London. The event was the first ever SDC-SDUK member gathering, and the conversation entitled Artistic Leadership, Directing Internationally, and Advancing the Craft featured artistic leaders Jeremy Herron and Pam McKinnon. It was moderated by SDUK Executive Director Thomas Hescott.
Thank you so much. If you don't know, I'm Thomas Hescott. I'm the Executive Director of Stage Directors UK, and we represent almost as many directors as SDC. One day we will. And thank you to Maureen from SDC and Liz from SDUK for setting this up and finding the venue doing all of the work that it takes to put this on and providing brilliant food. So thank you very much. I love events like this because this is how SDUK started. It was a group of directors coming together in a room in Covent Garden and wanting to change the landscape for directors. And 5 years on, it's easy to take that for granted, but actually it's still pretty revolutionary in the UK for directors of all sort of shapes, sizes, all different experiences to come together like this. So I'm always excited when we have events because it reminds us what we do and why we're here. And I'm really excited to do something with the SDC because there were two organisations when SDUK began which were hugely important to the success of SDUK and just got on the back of it. One was Directors UK, the screen and TV trade organisation, and the other was SDC, who, when they heard about us, have ever since then given us a huge amount of advice, support, and their knowledge over the years of how this works, and also, really importantly, gave us the money along with Directors UK to set up. And so without them, I really don't think SDUK would be here today. So it's brilliant that we're finally able to do something together. And maybe SDUK will send Liz and I over to New York to do the same later in the year. Or maybe not. So it's so lovely to have you in London and directing at the National. And Pam, you arrived yesterday, didn't you?
Yes, boy, are my arms tired.
Thank you for taking your rest day to come and talk to us. And Jeremy, you're in New York all the time, it seems, at the moment.
Yeah.
So thank you for giving us a bit of time as well.
Pleasure.
You both run one of the most important theatres in the US. You run one of the most important companies in the UK. I think whenever your names are mentioned, the word that follows it, or the word that precedes it, is busy. You're two of the busiest directors around. So I'm just wondering, both, how do you juggle your time as an artist, the sort of producing element of being an artistic director, and also your commitments to SDUK and the STC and the work you do helping directors? How do they complement each other, and how do you juggle those things?
Yeah, I think, my name is Pam McKinnon, and I am president of the executive board of SDC. And that, I guess, I've been that 2 years, I think. And I've been on the board, I think, before that, maybe 3 years, and got involved with SDC through collective bargaining moments. Late at night, groups, across the table, figuring out long-term financial and other relationships with producers. So my work with the union has been strong for a while, Also, before this July, I was a freelance director, solely a freelance director. I have never had an office until this July. I've never had an assistant until this July that wasn't, you know, just project-based. So a freelance director in New York and sort of all over the U.S. I've directed, I guess, 8 things on Broadway. So the last sort of 6 years have been sort of Broadway-focused as a freelance director. And I answered a phone call about a year ago from a headhunter to ask me if I'd be interested in running a particular theater in San Francisco called American Conservatory Theater, which is a larger theater, 53 years into its history. And with each sort of interview step, I got more interested as opposed to less interested, and then I wound up being offered and took the job. And so the juggle is recent for me. It's been the last 6 months. And I guess at every turn, I just feel like the conversations are similar. That it is about scaling up what sort of who I am and what I believe in the rehearsal hall, scaling that up to, you know, a conference room, scaling it up to thinking about a whole season as opposed to choosing to do one play. So it feels like similar muscles are working, but maybe working a little harder. A little less about ever having a moment to myself, but it feels good. It feels like everything is very complimentary. I'm here at the National doing a show, a play by Bruce Norris. Bruce and I have known each other more than 20 years. This is the 4th play of his that I'm directing, and it's a co-production with a theater in Chicago where I've worked a number of times, Chicago and the National, and was built to be start at Chicago in Chicago and come to London. So it's the same company. And when I got the job in San Francisco at ACT, this was a project that I couldn't let go because it's for all the reasons I just mentioned. And then I have another project that also is a play that I've been working on for 6 years that is finally getting its world premiere in New York. And I was not going to let that one go either. And I let go of 2 things. I let go of a Broadway show, and I let go of another project, you know, when I became artistic director. Because, like, the juggle is furious, but I knew that it couldn't be generic. And those 2 other projects felt a little more generic than the ones that I've, as a director in the room, held on to. The juggle is exciting and a lot. You know, I also recognize that as an artistic director, I mean, the first time to have, like, I have staff. So, you know, it is about leading, but in conversation, and then trusting that those people actually are sentient, interested, plugged in, will reflect back, you know, that we can continue conversation, which I also feel is what rehearsal is. That's my ramble.
And Jeremy, you were...
That's what I was going to say.
I know.
That.
I know.
I mean, you were SDUK's first co-chair, I think. Oh, well, second if Piers was briefly chair, I think.
Yeah.
When Piers took on the executive's role, you and Kate Saxon shared the chair role. So did you find that was a conflict running a company and...
I find there was like an ethical conflict, although some of our colleagues struggle with that as being artistic directors versus being, part of an organisation that's agitating for pay and conditions. I actually felt that there was no conflict because I could maybe support directors much more helpfully.
Yeah.
When I was in charge of the conversations about how much we pay people and what we pay them for. So that felt like a kind of a good opportunity to do a bit of hit and run on the industry. So, you know, that was kind of, I've always been a director before anything else. And it feels like investing in the long-term benefits for directors, particularly directors coming through, feels like an important place to start the journey. And I certainly run the company with that in mind, thinking about what the director's experience is and how it's best to make the work happen. I suppose it just happens, isn't it? We all start in our careers facing seemingly insurmountable barriers and impediments because the industry looks like I suppose it's easy for me in the position that I'm in now to describe our industry as meritocratic, and I think to a certain extent it is, just because in my experience directing, I hope I don't offend anybody here, but we've got quite a weird combination of personality traits in order to actually make the directing possible and to make the shows possible. You need kind of a very firm grip, you need a sort of monomania, you need to be inclusive, you need to be collectively minded, there's a certain intellectual demand, there's a sense of fun and of play and of outsourcing your creativity to the rest of you. I mean, it's just a weird combination of skills that I think make a really great director. And those skills are really difficult to spot. It's through the work and it's through that determination that you work it out. And I think certain barriers, for example, in terms of gender, class, ethnicity, notwithstanding, I think it becomes apparent over the course of several years whether somebody can direct or not. So it's been my objective is to kind of discover that in myself and to keep in the game until I could work out whether I was any good as a director, and to do likewise for other directors. And that's where there's no conflict, I think, in terms of running headlong and being a member of SD UK. I mean, you started the question, Tom, about talking about that sort of busyness, and just to loop back to answer it, it feels to me on a personal level that when you start, you've got these ideas about what you want to achieve and what it might be possible to achieve. And if you get a little bit of success and you get those opportunities, it feels churlish to turn them down and to not be. And it sounds like we're of a slightly similar mindset, in the sense that I just try and scoop up all of those experiences and try and make as many of them happen as possible. And the thing, if you're lucky and you manage to keep going, the thing that enables that for me is just a great team at the company that it enables all of that. And there's something great that happens when you're really busy. It means that you have to relinquish a certain amount of control, mm-hmm. just for practical reasons. So it feels like it's at that point that that your appointments are really even more crucial, because it's not like you're having to do everything yourself or be so insecure about what so-and-so is going to do with the project that you have to watch them like a hawk. It feels like there's much more interest in terms of the engineering of the appointments empowering people to make great decisions and then feeding off that. So at a particularly busy time, it's really wonderful to be presented with ideas or suggestions from colleagues that are genuinely energizing. So that's a way of answering the question. I think it's like that kind of essential impulse to make work that I assume that we all have in this room, and a hell of a lot of luck to enable there to be a sort of structure to settle around my work in order to make that happen. And as far as SD UK is concerned, that energy is there because it's really important and really necessary, and there's just been an urgency about changing the game because of that, and a collective will has settled around that. I've certainly bored myself enough, so I'll stop talking.
You, a lot of your work has either transferred to America, or you've also created work in America from scratch. Is it the same? Is it the same as creating work in London, or is it a very different experience?
Yeah, really good question. Like the George Bernard Shaw thing comes to mind. You know, two countries separated by the same language. It feels like it's very similar, but also very different. And you suddenly hit across those assumptions. Like just even the way it's structured and the relationship with producers, for example, it feels different. And it depends project by project. I'm doing a musical at the moment that aspires to get to Broadway in 2020. And so I'm working with a cohort of four producers, a composer and lyric writer, a writer and lyric writer, and me, as well as a whole creative team. And that feels like a really interesting combination of people who are deeply invested in the project and are certainly not shy at opinionating about what it is. And it's been a really interesting process to try and work out their particular agendas and their particular motivations. What's important to them? Is it just about the finance? Is it about this making some money back? Or are we all believing in the same artistic imperative? And if so, does that conflict with the money? And then, you know, you can spend a bit of time sort of worrying about that. And actually it comes down to making a really great show and trying to make a case for the great show and hoping that whatever financial imperative is behind the show aligns with that. And if it doesn't, then I'll probably get sacked and there it is. But I can only do it in one particular way. And I think the sooner you start getting into second guessing other people's needs and trying to service them is a fundamental misunderstanding of what you've been booked for. Is that those producers knew my work, I think. Well, they'd seen it, seen a few examples of it. And you can only do what you can do and hope for the best. So that's been really interesting because unlike here, and certainly in the subsidised sector, and certainly in the commercial sector, those producers are slightly more back foot at saying what they think it should be. You know, or at least maybe my relationships with particular producers is evolved enough for them just to let me get on with it. This has been interesting because I'm very creative and really brilliant. And actually, I've never had the sense that any decisions have been made about money. In fact, most of the decisions that the producers offer to me to fulfill the artistic imperative of the project seem to be jaw-droppingly expensive. I can't believe it. So that's interesting. But I've also worked in the not-for-profit sector at the Roundabout, which is a bit of a halfway house. For those of you that don't know, Roundabout is a not-for-profit theatre company in New York with three spaces, is that right? Six spaces?
Six spaces, yeah.
Three of which I haven't been to.
but three are commercial.
Yeah, so you've got Studio 54, you've got the American Airlines on 42nd Street, and Laura Powell's.
Sondheim.
That's theirs.
And then the Pels is not for profit, and then there's an underground space as well.
So, and yet philosophically, it feels like the aesthetic and the imperative feels commercial, or at least part of that conversation.
It's sort of the closest we've got is probably the Old Vic, isn't it? Which is effectively a non-for-profit organisation operating on a commercial model.
Yeah. And yet with smaller spaces.
Yeah.
So that feels like it's in conversation with the Broadway aesthetic, but a bit more similar, I suppose, to subsidised theatres here, without really having that kind of social grip, that kind of desire to plug into what's happening at street level. And then St. Anne's Warehouse in Brooklyn, which I took a show to, which is a sort of receiving art, a curated receiving theatre, effectively, which runs on a curious artistic financial model, I think, whereby the visiting companies, as far as I'm aware, raise the money in order to bring their show there. But it's the most fantastic space, a really adaptable and just a really wonderful space where you can create some good stuff. So I've had a kind of good view of it. And it's interesting. It does feel to me, I mean, we're talking about similarities and differences. It does feel to me the kind of theatre tribe, as it were, is the same tribe. It doesn't take long to get into the same space and to work out that that we all want to make shows and we want to make them as well as we can. So it didn't feel like a huge cultural leap. There's a few other things that we could probably go on to talk about, but what's your experience, Pam? That.
You mean not for profit versus commercial, or
yeah?
I mean, yeah, I've yet to work in London, so
tomorrow,
get back to me at tea time tomorrow. That will be different. I've definitely worked. You know, I moved to New York like 27 years ago. I didn't study theater. I did some self-producing. I fell in with some friends who started a downtown company, and they were both actresses, and so they turned to me and said, "You're a director." So I directed 7 of their first 9 productions, and this is a company that's still alive and well. It's called Clubbed Thumb.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if you took a thumb and clubbed it. It's a, I guess it's a palmistry term. If you have a sloping pad, you don't need to look at your thumbs, but, you know, privately do. If it slopes forward, it's a sign of perseverance. So that's a horrible name for a company, but there it is. You know, and
it's sort of Heidi Schreck.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Porsche Krieger.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And so, you know, felt very much, you know, while I was also self-producing and directing in small places, felt very much the recipient of other people's institutional ambition, and started working a lot with playwrights and on new plays. And then I met Edward Albee a few years into my time in New York and started to direct some of his then new plays, and he introduced me to some larger theaters because he was, you know, a very established playwright. And I, you know, worked at universities as well, and Juilliard, which is an acting conservatory, and then I started working off Broadway, and you know, more recently I said I've worked on Broadway a lot. And I mean, I guess my with the exception of an original musical, which also felt very producey, hands-on, I mean, creative producers, also some very green producers who started to almost self-emulate, so that was hard. But generally I felt the producing angle just very supportive, very, you know, we hired you for a reason kind of people. So that all feels good and normal. I mean, Broadway also has, you know, if something is created for Broadway, the first couple of things that I did were not created for Broadway. They wound up on Broadway, which is very different. I mean, Broadway also definitely has a big interest in marquee actors. And I've worked on some projects that were built around that. You know, Al Pacino in, you know, that kind of thing, and that does feel a little different. It does feel different to be a director when you recognize that you aren't sort of like at times the leader. And I don't mean like leader in the room, because Al and I had a fine relationship, but there was so much pressure from the get-go on him.
And was he attached to the project before you were?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. You know, and without him it wouldn't have happened.
Sure.
I mean, so that does feel a little different, and that is a big part of Broadway.
Yeah.
You know, that to get a new play, especially on Broadway, it either has to have come from somewhere else and already have that, you know, 5-star review or whatever, or have a big star attached, and that does feel, as a director, sometimes fantastic. Because sometimes those people are exactly like, roll up your sleeves and let's make something great. And sometimes that spotlight and the fear factor that happens, I think, you know, in those shiny arenas to the best of people can get a little, it can get a little dodgy. It's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard.
You mentioned that the project, the Bruce Norris play, Opening the National, was designed from day one to be transatlantic.
Yeah, yeah.
Was there any, so far has there been any kind of pull? Was there any kind of, was the culturally setting that up? Was that all smooth sailing, or did you notice any difference in the approach to producing it across the channel?
No. I mean, it was great. It was very much so. So I have 2 American designers and 2 UK designers, and we decided that the like plastic arts, so sets and clothes, should be American, as we put it up in Chicago for the first time, and that the more sort of time, go through time, be there for all of tech, you know, so sound and lights be UK, so that we could have multiple visits with the sets and clothes and just have a long sustained, you know, one-off but long with the other designers. And that, I think, was smart. It's a cast of 8. We wound up casting 5 Americans, 4 of whom are in the Steppenwolf Acting Company. It's a large company. It's a And that's sort of the core of Steppenwolf is an acting company. So four of whom are there, but five Americans and three Brits. So I came over, I guess, in April, and the weather was not this lovely, and had auditions at the National, saw some wonderful people, and hired three of those people. And they came over for Chicago rehearsals. And I mean, it's a play that takes place in the States. And I think it was useful sort of for dialect and vowel sounds for those three actresses to, you know, be in that milieu. And then we ran it there for a couple months. And now, and I guess it stopped around end of November. So what is that? December, like sort of 3 months later, we're going back in. We'll rehearse for a week and a half. We'll be in technical rehearsals and we'll have a week of previews. Yeah, but it's exciting. I mean, it felt, you know, I know that this was originally a play that was commissioned by Steppenwolf. And there was a moment when the artistic director was made nervous by the play. If you see it, you'll understand why. And she wasn't convinced that that their company should do it. And Bruce Norris had some nice relationships over here, the Royal Court especially, with Dominic there. And so shopped it around here, you know, thought, okay, well, if the commissioning theater doesn't want to do it, I'm now free to shop it around. And Rufus at the National loved it. And when Anna Shapiro, the artistic director at Steppenwolf, got word of that, she became more comfortable. And so that's so that was the setup. You know, so Rufus was all in, and Anna still had the commission, and together felt like, oh, well, this is, you've sort of validated my interest and erased some fear. And, you know, but because she originally had the fear, and she's also a director of Bruce's plays, I, again, was sort of the lucky recipient of, you know, someone, yeah, sort of saying no, and I got the yes after that. Yeah, it's been exciting.
Steppenwolf has an ensemble, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And am I right that that the ADC used to have an ensemble and doesn't anymore?
Yeah.
Out of interest, working with ensembles and working without ensembles, what's the what are the advantages and disadvantages?
Yeah, I mean, at Steppenwolf, I guess also the Alley Theater, which is a larger theater in Houston, Texas. They still have an acting company. You know, I sort of feel like New York City's a big acting company. You know, I work with some, you know, have like repeat offenders. I mean, I like the like some cross pollination. I think I would find it stifling if it was the same company all the time. But Steppenwolf doesn't even adhere to that. I definitely, you know, have. Like, for instance, I did a production of Albies, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and my George and Martha had known each other for 22 years, the same length of time of that stage marriage. They had played a married couple 7 times prior on stage. When they were in their early 30s, they had dated briefly. I mean, so I get to step into something that's emotionally rich and ongoing, and get to play from the get-go. So that feels, I mean, that's the pros, right? And then the cons, I think, you know, I can't imagine. I mean, I'm 6 months into being an artistic director, you know, to also have an acting company as I'm thinking about programming a season, as I'm thinking about who gets what, as I'm thinking about, oh my God, I'm not sure he's an ingenue anymore, what happens now? Like, that sounds very, very taxing. So, yeah, so I don't have to worry about that.
And you said that New York felt like one big acting company. Jeremy, as someone who's worked over there and over here, do you see London in that way? Do you think we have the same kind of community? Obviously, there's a difference between there seems to be a different relationship between London and the regions and New York and the rest of America. But do you see the same kind of communities in the UK that there are in America?
Difficult to say. I mean, my sense of it, you'll know much more about this than me, but my sense of it is that Broadway is an entity in the way that the West End isn't. Broadway, through whatever reasons, when we were chatting about it, Tom, you suggested that it might have something to do with the way that community responds to the AIDS crisis, or there's just some kind of connective tissue between those productions those actors, those creatives, that either we don't care to acknowledge in the same way here, or that it just simply doesn't exist. I mean, certainly, I think it's true to say that in our culture, if you can, if you know, one of your shows gets to the West End, then that's kind of good. But you hadn't started. Well, I certainly never started thinking the West End is where I want my work to be. You know, it's always been a nice way of extending the life of a show. Or latterly, it's the only place that you can get to work with a particular actor on a particular project. And I think the thing that's underneath all of these conversations is the spectre or the lack of subsidy in the US, and the fact that it exists for us and has underpinned most of our careers, and it's why we got into the theatre in the first place, because we were probably taken to a civic theatre that was publicly funded and it inspired us and we went on a journey. It's a different culture in America. And yet it's not simplistic, or it's quite contradictory. I'm just about to do a production of Well, My Son's, Miller's great play that was first done in 1947 and that opened on Broadway and ran for 100 odd, even more performances. You know, a serious play that was the tragedy of a particular working man, and really pointing the finger unapologetically to the economic system in America at the time. And yet it was lauded, and he came back 2 years later with the snappily titled Death of a Salesman, which the producers were begging him to change the title of, because it felt like it spelt commercial suicide. But he insisted that the title of the play was Death of a Salesman, and it seemed to work out quite well. So, you know, that commercial context could support difficult, challenging work. I mean, Olby, for example, you know, that was his home. Sondheim is a product of that culture. Williams, you know, those people are lauded and supported and then kind of ignored. What was it like for Olby at the end of his career? Was it a similar sort of thing that he wasn't?
The end was good. He had a really problematic middle because critics and the public turned on him. You know, to the point where, he was very ostracized from American theater. He taught. He did something called Olby's Men. He would rent a white van and with a couple actors go to college campuses and do like a speaking tour. And this was, you know, after 3 Pulitzers and
wow.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And, you know, so it's, you know, for me as, you know, as a colleague and friend, it's, you know, it's a good lesson that there's nothing linear about
yeah.
life or a career. And then he was commissioned at Vienna's English Theater, tiny theater in Vienna, to write a play. And he wrote 3 Tall Women. And that was first done there. And then it was brought back to the States by a commercial producer and friend of his, Liz McCann, very much a pioneer woman of Broadway commercial theater. She and her business partner, Nell Nugent, were like the 2 women GMs in the 70s. And she brought Edward back and produced 3 Tall Women. And then he had this amazing third act.
Yeah.
And that's when I got to know him.
Yeah. So I don't know. The similarity, there's enough that's similar. It does feel like everything costs so much more. The culture is slightly different. The union, I mean, it's interesting talking, being a proud member of SDC as well as SD UK, that we have a completely different relationship with labour unions. And you could argue that the local one, the crew union, and their rights and their paying conditions create a different context for making work in a way that it's cheaper to do it in. It's one of the factors that makes it cheaper in London. And that's interesting. And I find myself sort of pulled between believing in the power of a union and the importance of a union versus frustration at you know, the added costs that means that there's a certain level of economic caution. Therefore, you know, you need Al Pacino to do your new play, you know, rather than opening something in that context is just too expensive for producers to take a chance with necessarily, unless they're unless they're shoring their investment up in one way or another. I mean, the West End is bad enough for that, but it's, I think it's 8 times more expensive, Broadway.
Sounds right.
I think it's about that.
Although we're catching up in the West End.
Well,
still not paying people properly.
Yeah, and the ticket prices are catching up for sure.
Yeah. We should open it up for questions. Has anyone got anything they want to ask? If not, we'll eat lots of food.
One thing that occurred to me that we could talk about, because you were talking about auditioning over here. I'm always amazed at the different culture of auditions in New York. It's kind of brutal stroke, completely honest. In that there's no small talk, that we would spend 20 minutes probably auditioning for somebody. Maybe 15 if we're in a busy. But 20 minutes is probably standard, wouldn't you say? Yeah? Whereas in New York, in my experience, you have 5 people an hour and they're expected to kind of, their timings are expected to move back and forward in case you just need 5 minutes with somebody so that you're not kept waiting. And then they come in and they do their thing, and if it's a musical, they do their song and then they go. And there's very little sort of connective moment or direction involved. And I always find that really kind of exposing and awkward and awful. And so when I find that so embarrassing and I try to step behind, you know, from behind the desk and go and make a connection with the actors and offer them some direction, you're looked at as if you're the biggest freak on the planet. But this isn't how it's done. Have you got any reflections on?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can set the tone. I think, you know, in the States, I mean, I've certainly, for some projects, have wanted maybe a more UK-style audition process and have put that in the system through the casting director. But you're right that to do it sort of unannounced, the actor is going to be as terrified, and not be able to put their best foot forward because that's not what they're expecting.
Yeah.
But you can certainly put that into the system.
Yeah, and yet there's something really great and sort of
honest
about the fact that this is a professional encounter,
right?
And that I get a chance to show my prep, and then I'm out of there, and then they make their decision.
Yeah.
Whereas we sort of, typically British way, hide it under a kind of
the veneer,
faux
social
interaction.
It's so good to see you. Yeah.
I found that being on the receiving end of just having to pitch to some Americans and being really appreciative that I was told I've got 20 minutes slot. Myself and my colleague put together a pitch, learnt it, presented it as a sort of mini monologue kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they said, thank you very much, ask some questions. And I found that much more refreshing and enjoyable than the come in for a cup of coffee where we're sort of pretending not to pitch, where we're having a conversation where we're pitching and sort of but it's all subtext. It's sort of going and going, this is my project, this is what it is, have you got questions, and answering the questions is quite nice after years of sort of let's have a coffee and have half an hour of small talk where I'm going to try and edge in that I really want to do this. But
you've both spoken about sort of institutions feeling more cautious financially. I suppose it'd be great to hear what your advice is to freelancers as people run institutions in the face of kind of that caution and the desire to not take risks. It's quite hard coming with projects to know, what is the most effective way to approach institutions in this climate.
Do you mean, just both sort of Britain and US? We sort of answer it separately. So I would hope. Well, I certainly wouldn't frame it to myself as being risk averse, but I would certainly feel at the moment that my company Headlong is the company that I'm the artistic director of is one of the big strands of its work is touring work with co-producers regionally, and because of the effect of the economy of austerity, a lot of those local councils who used to fund, up to about £100,000 a year have taken a lot of that money away, if not all of it, which means that finding co-producers is much harder. And because the economy is as it is, despite seeing all the cranes on the skyline in London and seeing the kind of boom of the soon to depart European money. Don't be fooled that the rest of the country isn't having a really shit time, because it is. And that's where someone a company like Headlong is suffering. I hope not risk averse in terms of the artistic plan, but it's certainly more challenging to find a title that a co-producer is going to sign up to. So my feeling about that is, for a director pitching an idea, they need to be pretty canny about what is going to light the dashboard up for the co-producer, and to think about titles that a co-producer is going to get happy about supporting. For a company like Headlong, we're in a part of a triangle. So that's what I'd suggest. And it's a, you know, the kind of thing that we do is, I suppose, is we aim for a title that people have heard of, that doesn't sound like it's going to be exciting or challenging in any way, and make it challenging. And in terms of actually sort of being cautious in this culture, it feels like that caution is expressed by fewer and fewer opportunities for a freelance director. You know, it feels like the Broadway producer, they want to mitigate that risk in as many ways as possible, so a smaller group of directors get in the work. I don't know whether that answers your question. It's a bit bleak.
Well, that's realism, which is helpful.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a way to break through. But as ever, it's the great ideas, or the ideas that are irresistible, that will get the increasingly small amount of opportunities.
And Pam, can I ask, do you have directors coming pitching to you? And do you have advice for freelance directors?
6 months into being an artistic director, I mean, I chose the season that's currently running before I was boots on the ground, and chose sort of based on titles, based on, you know, sort of, I leaned heavily on my associate artistic director, who'd already been at ACT in San Francisco for 4 years, and, you know, sort of figuring out like what are, I have a 283 seat theater, an end space proscenium theater, and then I also have a 1,000 seat Beaux Arts, you know, kind of Broadway. I go like this with for muscle, like Broadway house, and you know, some plays can really soar in that big. It's actually quite an intimate. I just worked there. I just directed there for the first time just this last month. Can really soar in that like three tiered. It's a orchestra, a mezzanine, and a balcony, and then others just shouldn't experience that room. And so, you know, a lot of my thinking is about like what kind of play muscle. Doesn't have to be a huge company, but it has to have like the big ideas and have really, I don't know, sort of toothsome language to be in a space like that. And there was one play that's in rehearsal right now. Play by Lauren Yee, who's actually a San Francisco-based writer, and she, we first put her play, it's a basketball play, it's four characters, she was sort of a natural fit, I thought, for the smaller theater, and then in thinking through it a little bit more, and living with her play a little bit more, and also the fact that she's from San Francisco, the fact that this play takes place in San Francisco and Beijing, the fact that it's basketball and very much a basketball city, so sort of started to thematically think that could cradle some risk. We've put it into the big space, got the right designer, got the right director to think in those bigger scaled up terms, and that feels wildly exciting to me, that this, you know, 30-something writer that's only starting to get sort of national attention, that ACT is producing her for the first time in her hometown and putting her on the main stage. So that, but it's a San Francisco story. Like I needed something a little additional, you know, and who knows, it could all tank and I could be, you know, it could be running at 20% in 2 weeks. But it feels like a good, smart, canny kind of like, you know, yeah, this is the kind of theater this theater should be doing, and what the city doesn't know they want but wants. So, you know, so that sort of goes into some of my thinking.
Do you have subscribers? Is mm-hmm. it a subscription
we
audience?
We have some subscribers. But but you know, like any US theater in, you know, marching through the 21st century, that number is getting smaller and smaller.
And what about corporate responses? Do you have a lot of that?
soon, any day now.
Because that's something that's talked about a lot in the UK is the big businesses that want to fund theatre to improve their image and how whether we take that money or not.
Yeah, I'd love to take a little bit of, you know, the telephone company AT&T used to have their name on the San Francisco baseball park, and they recently left that, and it's now called Oracle. I don't even know what Oracle does, but it's sort of like, does AT&T want to have my theater? I mean, I'd love that. Some contract of, you know, I mean, I don't know what that is, like 5 years for $10 million. Could that, I mean, I do not have a problem with that now that I have a big house that sits on a corner of two busy streets.
Would you draw the line in terms of what that corporation does?
Yes, like the Hustler Theater, no. You know, Larry Flint's, no.
Okay, there's a line. Yeah.
There's my line, yeah. Cigarettes, no. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could say a little more about differences between sort of various theatre hubs in the States, like in terms of regional differences between, for instance, East Coast and Midwest and West Coast, or are they markedly different?
Yeah, I mean, they're you know, I've worked a lot throughout the U.S., you know, Chicago, I'm sure, gets talked about a lot, maybe even here, as being like a real theater town. And it's not just the large theaters of Steppenwolf and the Goodman and the Chicago Shakespeare Theater, but it's also, there's a big storefront scene, and that's what it's called. It's a storefront, you know, off-loop scene. It's alive and well. And it's largely non-union. We're interested in SDC starting to, you know, really sort of do some good work in Chicago and make more of our members and also potential members aware that the union has advantages. But there is this storefront scene that at this point is largely non-equity, largely not SDC. And it's where some of those larger theaters then come from. So that's an interesting theater town, and it's culturally, it feels like people go to the theater. It might be a faction of like winter is brutal, you know, and winter starts in like mid October and goes to April,
get somewhere warm.
You know, you don't need windows, like just do it. You know, I've also worked like Washington D.C. has an interesting theater scene, and I think it's far enough away from New York, but close enough, that it can sort of survive and be its own entity. When you start getting to Philadelphia, it's almost a little too close to New York to sort of have.
Yeah.
Although, you know, there's a wonderful artistic director, Blanca Ziska, at the Wilma Theater, and she recently, because it's so close to New York, she got bored with sort of the one regional theater model of, you know, just bringing in New York directors and New York actors. And so she started to create her own acting company, Philadelphia-based, and they work on things for years. It's much more an Eastern European model. She's originally from Prague, and so that's exciting. I've also done a lot of work, you know, in Southern California. It does feel a little weird to go into a windowless room, but there's some good theater that's being done. Even in like conservative Orange County, there's a large older theater called South Coast Rep, and while their taste is maybe kind of a little more sort of straight ahead, you know, linear narrative, a little bit middle of the road, they have created audiences that will go in and watch a new play like nobody's business. you know, and it's like they do not have to know what, like, they do not have to have title recognition, writer recognition. They are like, we are all in, tell us a good story, and we will show up.
And that's because it's been good over the years.
45 years.
And those audiences have been rewarded. They've been rewarded.
But that is 45 years in, and it really is active training. And, you know, and so, yeah, they're interesting pockets. And sometimes it surrounds one theater, and sometimes it's a bit of a scene.
In this country, the sort of regions are very much a training ground for not just directors, but creators as a whole. I think all kind of roads lead to London if you succeed or recognise. Is that the same in the States, or are you stay in those hubs and you just stay in those areas?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really depends on the person. I think there are, you know, a lot of people that, yeah, it's sort of like, if I don't make it to New York, then what have I done? But then certainly there are Chicago directors and actors that that can make a living and really dig in and do great work. I think it's quite a mix. I mean, it's such a larger country just geographically. You know, there are also our, you know, theater towns that are theater towns. Like, I'm thinking of Seattle, a great theater scene, and then a couple theaters, and also like tech companies coming in, and so audiences changing, and it changed the culture, and it's not really seen as like the big theater town that it was even 20 years ago. So there is, at times it feels precarious, and maybe a little charismatic. I mean, and charisma is fantastic until it goes. It's interesting. You know, I've never worked there, but like Minneapolis also has, there's both like a really like bread in the bone. Maybe it's because there's a large core of Scandinavian ancestry, so like bread in the bone of philanthropy, as well as, and that's tied to the arts. And so the Guthrie Theater has like private donors that most theaters are just so envious of, and that's true for theater, and that's true also for their museum culture. The U.S. is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly suffer from that here, and it's a company like Headlong, we're often trying to deal with that sense that not everything should happen in London, you know. And the fact is that there's a much bigger labour market in terms of talent and the projects coming up, but there should be somebody's birthday.
Nice.
We should be trying to energise those regional scenes, because not everybody wants to come to London or is able to come to London. It feels like there's, certainly for directors, it feels like there's a track in London that you can get on, get the stimulation and see the work that sort of European influence and whatever, and there's a community that can you can progress alongside, you can find your peers, and it seems that there are a few people that are trying to address that regionally.
I mean, it's part of my impulse for moving to San Francisco. I mean, I'm interested in affecting a scene, you know, and at ACT, this current season of like, you know, what is the balance of out of town, primarily New York, Chicago talent, and local San Francisco Bay Area talent on our stages, and that's an interesting puzzle for me to think about. And I'm, you know, I directed Edward Albee's Seascape as my inaugural show at my larger theater, just closed a week ago. And I guess we budgeted two out of town actors and two local actors, but I saw some great people, and I wound up working with three local actors and one out of town actor. You know, it's a mix of also directors and designers that are local and out of town. And it feels like, as the big theater in that smaller theater scene, and a big theater that can also pay people, that we can really influence the ecosystem and hopefully get more artists to, as they're coming up, to realize, oh, I can stay. And that feels really exciting to me.
That feels very similar to the UK at the moment. It does feel like there's a shift. I certainly think if I was starting out now, I'd move to Manchester, not London. Uh-huh. I think there's a really interesting hub of big theatres and companies alongside a really interesting fringe scene
yep.
there. We're seeing that with a lot of the funding as well, that theatres are starting to go, what's our local mm-hmm. Community of artists mm-hmm. like, as opposed to satelliting in people from London. But it's just starting to change,
yeah.
really, in the last couple of years. I mean, Manchester's not yet Chicago, but it feels like it could become as vibrant as that. Or maybe it is, I don't know. But
all of these cities are very particular. You know, yeah. it's a kind of... I often think about it's like what's happened to the high streets in all of these towns. That there's a cost of coffee, there's kind of... You have to really fight back in order to maintain mm-hmm. a kind of legitimate diversity. And I think that's up to... it's great what you're saying, Pam, because I think it's up to us to be insisting on not diversity in terms of representation, because that feels that argument is in play and that's really great. But diversity in terms of the stories that we talk about and where those through which lens those stories are judged, and feels like because London is one of the world's great theatre cities, feels like we should rebalance a little bit. And have a look at those places. Manchester is, I mean, there's so many great cities with so many great artists, and they just need a bit more investment, and it's a challenging environment.
It is financially led as well, isn't it? Manchester's vibrant because it's got a forward-thinking council that like to support it, because it's got businesses like Bruntwood that want to support Manchester, and then there's other cities that could equally be that, but don't have that sort of investment going in. We've probably got time for one more question. Yes.
I would love to hear both of your perspectives on diversity and inclusion on your stages, because I'm sort of watching theater here in London and recognizing a diverse scene on stage. And I do know that in America that it's a bit of a necessary labor. So I'd love to hear sort of how you're both approaching that.
What do you mean by a necessary labor?
In America, there's a lot of talk about making sure that we diversify. It seems like there's a real strong movement to do it.
Uh-huh.
And my perception of London theatre is a little more effortless, but maybe I'm wrong.
Do you mean effortless as in we're already doing it or we're not interested in doing it?
No, we're already doing it, and it's kind of happening more automatic.
That's right. Nice to know.
I don't think that's the case. Well, my experience tells me that that's not the case, that these conversations are really nuanced and are ongoing. I'm always interested in what we mean by diversity and what sort of diversity that is. And is it the diversity that you can see, or is it systemic and structural? And I think, remember those productions that you'd see a few years ago where there would be a minor character played by an actor of colour? And that would look like the producers thought, well, we've satisfied that obligation. I'm sure I've done productions like that myself as well, with the vagaries of the casting, so I'm not pointing any fingers, but it feels like there's a culture of, tokenism is the wrong word, but a gesture towards diversity doesn't seem to properly address the issues. And those issues seems to me, who's telling the stories and what stories they're telling, and is that, from a theatre company's point of view, is that properly diverse? Is that as broad as we can make it? Or are the people that are in charge of that not working through their own biases, be they conscious or unconscious? So it feels like there's still quite a lot of work to be done in terms of that, because there is a system that loads against a genuine diversity. And I think, as far as I'm concerned, you've got to look at why people want to go to the theatre in the first place and why people are encouraged to work in the theatre professionally. By the time we get to the casting process or the commissioning process, the pool of genuinely diverse talent has already been impeded. And so I think it's up to people that are running companies like me to put in structural change so that you're having a look, and the benefits of that sort of inclusive process will probably happen 10 years down the line. And in the meantime, it's a scramble to find collaborators that are taking up opportunities that are right for them in a way that it means that your work is representative. So it feels like it's a two-pronged thing and really challenging, properly challenging, but important, and not important in a punitive way, but important in a creative way, in that those ideas challenge our preconceptions of what a story can be and what it's supposed to do. So that's what I feel about it.
Yeah, and I would echo a lot of that. I mean, but it's you know, it's something that, you know, I think and talk about a lot. And in some respects, I'm learning as a brand new artistic director that, you know, sort of pulling the lever of programming is in some respects the easiest lever to pull. I mean, I, you know, this season at ACT, five of my seven main stage plays are written by women. Slightly different configuration, but five of seven are written by people of color. I mean, the stories on the stage in very much involve, you know, quite a wide array of culturally diverse stories. But that's actually relatively easy, right? I mean, I can find a great play written by, you know, a fantastic Black American writer and produce it. What is harder is, you know, is, I mean, my audience is vastly majoritarian white. That's harder. I'd love if my basketball play written by Lauren Yee that largely takes place 10 blocks away in San Francisco Chinatown, I would love it if people from the Chinese American community of Chinatown knew we existed. So that's what I need to do. And also, you know, my hiring practices of my staff. It's a predominantly white institution. And we talk about this a lot of like, you know, sort of like what are the barriers of entry to, making welcoming, vis-a-vis the organizational health of my hallways, so that people of color on my staff or people of color that I would interview and want to be on my staff feel that they are represented and don't have to share the burden of being, you know, the one person in the room who isn't white. You know, I have to do that work.
It's interesting that you say that from your perspective, it's looking effortless in this country, because I think I certainly felt that it looks effortless in America and that we've got a long way to go, which does suggest that possibly there's a lot that we could, you know, we're all having the same conversations, that SDC and SDUK can really collaborate on that, because we're all talking about the same mm-hmm. thing and we've all got the same struggle there, because it's certainly not effortless in this country, and we've got...
And it certainly feels like, just to jump in,
yes,
it feels
please.
Interesting, is that it's going to blow. Phew. Is the class, is the kind of hidden, yeah. sort of seemingly hidden, or it's very difficult to define it or tick that box, because it's a sort of self-definition, I suppose.
And with class, the biggest thing is the structural changes that, because as you say, it's hidden, you know, the better the working conditions there are, the better the engagement in what a genuine career in the theatre looks like. All of those things make it accessible to all, and mean that we change those things, but they're the hardest things to change, you know, that the big structures that allow us to pay people properly, to, you know, all of those things.
Yeah, and in a time of austerity and sort of, yeah. minimum, you know, that feels challenging. There you are.
I'm going to bring this bit to a close, but obviously people please do stay around and eat and talk and
There's a lot of ham left.
Yes.
and cold chips.
But can I just say before we finish, a huge thank you to both of you for taking time out of your days to be here.
Especially absolutely.
And also just to SDC for being such a huge supporter and colleague with SD UK, an organisation that we really rely on to work with us. So thank you very much to SDC as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by SDC Foundation. SDC Foundation events and programs are designed to offer access, opportunity, and community to directors and choreographers at all levels of their career. To find out more, visit our website at www.sdcfoundation.org.